Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Now, most of us can identify a thing, or perhaps several, which we don't need to quit, but certainly do too much of. These little addictions build up, and the snowball effect can mean the sum total is huge. In her latest book, Little Addictions, best-selling author Catherine Gray explores how when we master these, we free up peace of mind, disposable income, time, well-being and happiness. Catherine, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And when you put it that way, little addictions, little things that we feel we might just do a little too often that can't really be that bad. But when you talk about peace of mind, disposable income, time, well-being and happiness, you can see that, the balance is a little off.
Absolutely. And what tends to happen is that it becomes a rolling stone that gathers, right? So say, for instance, if I at 10:30 when I'm meant to be going to bed, I click next episode and then I lose an hour of sleep. The next day, I'm only going to be a little bit smudged. I'm not going to ruin my day, but I'm more likely to overuse things like caffeine or sugar or nicotine, you know, pick up social media, spend longer on that to look for some fast dopamine. And it just means that these things incrementally gather consequences, and the individual consequences are tiny, but they really add up.
It's a really fascinating book. Not only do you deeply research all of these areas and all of the little addictions that we can all lean on from time to time, but it's also deeply personal. Even in your opening chapter, you talk and outline what your primary and secondary addictions are. Tell us a little bit about those, and how did you feel about sharing so openly?
I mean, I'm a chronic oversharer. I can't seem to help it. I always write about my personal life in my books. And I've written before about having big clinical addictions to alcohol and also cigarettes. And then I took a year off dating to conquer my love addiction, which was basically thinking I needed to get married to be a complete human. And these are very different. So there's a massive nuance between big addictions and little addictions. These aren't things that I want to quit. But I'll still fess up to them. You know, I have 10. I'm riddled with little addictions. And I still want to regain my agency to choose them. But unfortunately, I have no idea how to moderate because I'm very much a go hard or go home type of personality. So that's why I went out and asked 24 experts, how can I get on top of these? How do I balance them? How do I use them in the way that I intend to use them rather than find that I constantly use them a little bit too much?
So we've touched on some of them. Just so listeners are clear, what is the definition of little addictions and the difference between primary and secondary?
So primary and secondary addictions are, they relate to big addictions, so otherwise known as clinical addictions. And your primary addiction is something that might ruin your life. So it could be a gambler who stands to lose their house, or like I was, somebody who drinks to the point where, you know, they're drinking a life-endangering amount, or somebody who's smoking themselves into an early grave. That's primary and secondary. And what we tend to find is that once we crack open primary and secondary addictions, if you have a big addiction, there are lots of littler addictions inside. So I use the metaphor of a Russian stacking doll. It's like even once you've conquered the outer shells, there's still all these littler dolls inside. They're ever descending, but they're also unignorable. But even if you've never had a clinical big addiction, everyone out there has or has had some sort of little addiction. And I'm willing to die on the hill of a statement that actually most of us have several. And as soon as I mention the premise of the book to anyone, they can name them. So I think that's a sign that, you know, most of us struggle with using something a little bit too much.
So what do we need to understand about our brains and addictions, be them they big or small?
So what we need to understand is, so we are, many of these little addictions tap into ancient urges. First of all, I spoke with evolutionary psychologist and neuroscientist who told me that what we have is like a hunter-gatherer brain in a modern body and landscape. And many of the things that we use too much, say, for instance, social media, that taps into our urge to be accepted by our tribe or community. Because even 100 years ago, not being accepted, being ostracized, could have meant death. And you'll find that anything that is addictive, whether it's right move or ultra-processed food, taps into some sort of ancestral urge. So with Right Move, that's to do with our obsession to get the best cave, right? And that's why a lot of people find us looking for houses when we've got no intention of moving. With shopping, that taps into hunting and gathering and foraging, you know, all of those things that are very deep inside our neural hardwiring. So it's really interesting to trace it back to the roots and understand why we do it. And that's the first stage to beginning to get control over it.
How did you choose which addictions you were going to focus on for the book, or were they obvious? Are they common in all? Because, I mean, there is quite a long, extensive list you go through.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke, again, this was down to speaking to experts as well, but the 15 are alcohol, nicotine and cannabis, gaming, gambling and porn, our phones and ultra-processed food. But then there's some that are less expected. So, you know, caffeine, shopping, dating and sex. And then there's behavioral compulsions like people-pleasing, procrastinating, judgment and gossip, which are less known about, but they are still addictive. And we feel a withdrawal when we stop doing them.
So interesting. Maybe we could touch on a couple of them. What about that one you mentioned there, gossiping? I don't think that's one that people would think was addictive.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have thought so either. But once I started diving into it, so say, for instance, in Sapiens, the author writes about how gossip is basically constructed our larger communities, because what gossip does is it creates a shared moral conscientiousness around right and wrong. Because if you're being gossiped about, that tends to mean that the group think you've done something wrong. So gossip is like a community punishment, and it creates that moral fabric that so many communities are based upon. So actually, when you look back, gossip seems frivolous nowadays. You know, you have gossip columnists and celebrities being gossiped about, especially, you know, the Beckhams at the minute. But what we're doing as a community, but now it's on a global scale, is deciding who is right and who is wrong. And that's something that we cannot turn off. It's something that we want to do as humans naturally. So it's about being aware of that. We're not bad people if we gossip, but it does carry like a hangover. We do feel grubby afterwards, and that's not a great feeling.
I certainly felt that and become more conscious of it in recent years. You do kind of walk away and say, why did I go down that road, or why did I get sucked into that? And I know so much of it is natural. If something happens, you know, within a friendship group or a community, or even as you say, a celebrity story, people say, oh my God, did you hear? But it is that hangover. And is it that sort of high to low that is common in all addictions, that there's a high for a moment, but it's the come down, it's the hangover, as you described it. That's where the danger is.
Yeah, absolutely. And what happens is, so say, for instance, if we cast judgment on somebody, whenever we judge somebody, it carries a reward within our brain. It carries a neuroscientific buzz. This isn't me asserting this. This is my experts. So what happens is we get a high. So we feel a bit superior to them. And then afterwards, our dopamine, our baseline dopamine gets dragged beneath. So we go into deficit. So that carries a consequence. And that's why when we're doing things that are instantly gratifying, whether it is eating sugar or, you know, clicking on a gossip column and going into a scroll hole or buying something we probably can't afford, there is a deficit afterwards, because we go into a lack, and then we go into craving and we want more fast dopamine, whether it's via Facebook or, you know, whatever we want to reach for. So it's really interesting. We put ourselves roller coaster, and that's why little addictions tend to snowball. When we start a day with, say, caffeine and a sugary pastry and, you know, a gossip column, rather than starting it with something like a protein breakfast and taking our dog out for a walk and, you know, I don't know, writing gratitudes, that means that we end up on this roller coaster and we make choices that are less good for us for the rest of the day.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. Obviously, there's going to be times where we're going to enjoy a coffee or a pastry, but when we're constantly reaching for something, it's an indication that our own foundation is not perhaps as solid as it should be, and it might be worth looking at. Do you find, Catherine, you live differently since researching for and writing this book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and to be really clear, I love coffee and pastries. I have no intention of giving them up. I love clicking next episode. But what I was finding was that maybe only a third of my days were spent using things exactly the way I want to use them, right? So my intended usage and my actual usage, there was a mismatch there. Now that I've written the book and I've gathered all of these tips and, you know, found the ones that work for me, there's 130 in the book, but I've, you know, 10 maybe work for me on a day-to-day basis. What I find is that maybe now I spend two-thirds of my time using things exactly the way I want to. You know, my screen time is between 2 and 3 hours, just like I want it to be, rather than tipping up into 4 or 5. But I'm still going to have those days, and I call them teenage days, where I just want to lie down and watch 3 hours of TV and, you know, throw ultra processed food into my mouth and not do any adulting. And that's okay. I think it's really healthy to have that balance. But I did want the grander scheme to be more towards my best interest. So that's what I've found, that balance, and I'm really happy with it.
Yeah, just having some sort of control over it. There was one other thing I wanted to ask you before I let you go. In your conclusion, you mentioned heading off to a cabin to finish the writing of the book, which always has such romantic connotations to it, and how anybody would ever want to write a book. And it reminded you of a caravan in Donegal that your father had. Tell us about your times there.
Yeah, so I grew up in Northern Ireland. I know I don't sound like it in any way, but we moved to England when I was 10, and all of our family holidays were spent in Donegal, either in a cottage which had no running water and electricity, or in a caravan beside this lake. So, I mean, I have such amazing memories of going there. And it just really struck me when I went to this cabin, which was really overpriced. And, you know, you lock your phone into this little box and they give you things to make a fire. And I was just like, this is just like the caravan in Donegal. It's just that this costs £120 a night, you know. So I think many of us are seeking to recreate that experience where we leave our homes and we're unreachable. And we go to a caravan and, you know, we don't have TV because we don't have reception. And it's just bliss because we're unplugging from that constant grind and hustle. So I think many of us could do well to sort of recreate that in modern life now. And I think there really is a huge leaning. Everyone seems to be leaning that way. And I think we've reached peak addiction when it comes to phones and Wi-Fi and, you know, TV and all of that. And we'll really start to reclaim our time in the coming years.
Do you ever return to Donegal, Sarah Jessica Parker style?
Yeah, I went back last year and stayed in an old schoolhouse and there was no Wi-Fi. You know, we had to drive into the nearby village to get it. I absolutely loved it. My partner less so. My daughter loved it. You know, I went for a run, got chased by rams. It was amazing. And I'm planning to take her back there every couple of years at least so that she knows about her roots and, you know, really spend some proper time in Ireland.
Well, I really, really enjoyed the book. It's a lovely mix, as you say, of personal stories and science and understanding and really getting to the nub of something we're all living with, as you say, and practical advice on how we can manage it without necessarily having to live off-grid for the rest of our lives. The book is called Little Addictions. Best-selling author Catherine Gray, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Right, coming up after the break, 1 in 4 employees self-identify as neurodivergent, but do they feel supported in their workplace? I'll be finding out more when I'm joined by co-author of new research from DCU, Dr. Laura Gormley.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, one of the biggest inclusion issue in Irish workplaces was hiding in plain sight. New research from DCU suggests 1 in 4 employees is neurodivergent, yet many are struggling more, progressing less, and quietly burning out. The surprising part? The fixes aren't radical or expensive. Sometimes it's the smallest changes that make the biggest difference. Joining me to discuss this is one of those behind this research, Dr. Laura Gormley from the School of Inclusive and Special Education at DCU's Institute of Education. Laura, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire, and thank you for giving us this platform to open this conversation in a public way.
Tell us a bit about the research and what you were looking to find out more about.
I suppose my colleagues, Dr. Aoife Brennan, Dr. Christine O'Keefe and Dr. Izzy Fox, we started into this about 18 months ago, and we really wanted to gain a deep understanding of the workplace experience of corporate employees here in Ireland. But we were particularly interested in that lived experience of the neurodivergent employee. So we set out to understand that better. So we carried out a large scale survey, and the nerd inside of me was really happy. We got over 1500 responses across three corporate work sites, very different places, I suppose, in terms of work. And we were able to follow that up with focus groups to get a richer understanding from the neurodivergent employees around what they were telling us in the survey.
So this is the corporate workplace. So this is office 9-to-5 type work.
Absolutely, yes.
So what were some of the things that you heard?
Well, first and foremost, I think what was really interesting, and I was a little surprised, but not too surprised, was 1 in 4 identified or were diagnosed as neurodivergent. So that includes things like autism, ADHD, anxiety, depression, sensory processing differences, dyspraxia, dyslexia. Like, there are only a few of the neurodivergencies that were cited, I suppose, by the participants. And what we were surprised, I suppose, to see was that we don't have figures in Ireland around neurodiversity and the prevalence of neurodiversity in our population, but we're kind of, our figures are quite reflective of what we're seeing internationally. So it's 1 in 5 in the general population internationally. So surprised, but also, you know, also seeing what we're seeing internationally, which was great. Unfortunately, we did see that the well-being of the neurodivergent employees was significantly poorer than their neuromajority colleagues. We had almost 20% of the neurodivergent employees reporting that they had very, very poor well-being. We used a scale, the World Health Organization scale, to measure that. So that was one of our big findings.
And why is that? Is it more challenging for a neurodivergent person to show up to work every day? And is that what's draining their well-being?
That appears to be what is coming through. When you think about, like, going to work each day for any of us, it requires energy, cognitive energy, it requires mental energy, it requires physical energy. And those reserves can be depleted more quickly for neurodivergent employees who are having to adapt and try and perform in environments that are designed for the neuromajority. So things like bright overhead lights, things like hot desking, having to be in the office from 9-to-5, those can drain the battery of a neurodivergent employee much quicker than they do the neuromajority employee. Not to say that they don't drain everybody's battery, but that can happen much quicker for a neurodivergent person. So when that happens, you know, that impacts your well-being, your physical well-being, your emotional well-being. As a result, you're not going to be as productive or happy in the workplace.
And did this research speak to employees only, or did you get the opinions of the employers or line managers?
So we had a significant response from managers within the study. So over 50% of the neuromajority respondents were managers, and less so from the neurodivergent cohort. But we're also wondering, is that a reflection of the fact that in terms of career progression, the neurodivergent employee isn't progressing up the corporate ladder to the same degree as their colleagues? And I think that's something we have to explore further. We didn't in this particular study, but I think it's the starting point to explore that further. Like the accommodations that our neurodivergent participants suggested, like you said at the very start, really actionable, not crazy. You know, hybrid conditions, working conditions, but not just kind of your standard hybrid working conditions, true flexibility, giving them back the autonomy to be able to manage their own workload, trusting them that they know when they need to be in the office and when it's better for them not to be in the office. And if we can, when you think about going for a promotion, you're thinking about those extra responsibilities that you're going to have. And as a neurodivergent employee, then you're thinking, well, do I have the energy? Do I have the mental energy, the physical energy to take that extra piece on board? So if some of these accommodations are made in the workplace, then we might see neurodivergent employees becoming more confident around their capacity. But I also think we need to look at additional initiatives like the Athena Swan in Higher Education, which looks at promoting gender equality, something like that in corporate workplaces for the neurodivergent employee.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by this idea of flexibility. I don't know why we're so opposed to it. I don't know why we don't trust grown adults to show up and do their work. And if that isn't happening, well, then that's another, you know, case and situation that would need to be managed and discussed. But I really feel the majority of people, and the research bears it out, when you allow people to be open and honest about what is going on in their life and who they are, you get better productivity and better loyalty from the workforce. So it's actually a win-win. And yet, just because somebody is sitting at a desk from 9 to 5 doesn't mean they're necessarily working harder. And I do think we really need to start having these discussions. Where will this research go from here? Because you've made the recommendation, some of the things that you mentioned. What will happen with it?
I suppose companies are making moves around neurodiversity and have been doing so for the last couple of years. But what we're hoping with this report is to avoid this neuroinclusion illusion, whereby companies are making a stated commitment to embracing neurodiversity in the workplace, which is fantastic. But there's a gap with the day-to-day experience, that lived experience of the neurodivergent employee. It's not matching up. So what we're calling companies, we're calling corporate organisations now in a call to action to move beyond awareness and start to implement some of what we have in this report. They're actionable changes. They're small changes, even access to a quiet space. It doesn't have to be super sophisticated. It just has to be a space where maybe you could dim the lights, because it's not about a quiet space just in terms of what you can hear, but also your visual space as well. Dimmable lights, even, you know, creating a culture where it's okay to wear headphones or earplugs, that it's not just an accommodation for Mary. Everyone is invited to do so, because really we're trying to get across the point here that while this all was channeled through our neurodivergent participants, these suggestions and recommendations could be beneficial for every employee. For example, the parent who has been up late at night with a sick child, for someone who's caring for their elderly parents. Like, these recommendations can create an inclusive workplace for everybody, and everybody can benefit.
Yeah, because we talk about work-life balance as if they're two separate entities, but it's all life, all mixed up together in one bundle. And I think that's how we need to start talking about it. Empathy and awareness is one of your key recommendations. How easy is it for workplaces to engage in education and become more aware of how they can help or how they can ask to be supported more?
So within the workplaces that we surveyed, they have their own in-house education and training around neurodiversity. And the participants that we sampled were very positive, I suppose, about this particular training across all the three workplaces, which was really positive to see. But they did call for more co-production, more involvement of them, the neurodivergent people, in creating these trainings, these educational initiatives, so that the workplace, their peers, their managers can truly understand their experiences on a day-to-day basis. Because people are, coming out of the survey, people are accepting that accommodations are necessary and so on, but they might not be able to translate that into, okay, this is what is needed with the colleagues that I work with. So it's bridging that gap a little bit more. And our participants are definitely calling for that to be, for them to be part of that process.
Well, thank you for conducting this research. And it sounds like, as you say, this is, you know, one of the steps in something bigger. Things you learned here, you're going to bring into the next study. So when will that be happening?
Absolutely. We are hoping to get going on the next study and delve into certain aspects of what has come through in this piece of research. So looking at that career progression piece, looking at the well-being in more depth, you know, the importance of belonging and acceptance within the workplace. That's something that's very close to my heart, and I'd love to research more in that area now going forward.
Well, seeing as we're talking about the workplace, seems like a pretty cool job you've ended up with, Laura.
Oh, I'm very lucky. We I have to say, DCU is very neuro-inclusive and really, in terms of autonomy and so on, I'm very, very lucky.
Mm, and it seems like a bit of a passion. I can see your eyes light up when you're talking about the work you're doing. Report co-author Dr. Laura Gormley from the School of Inclusive and Special Education at DCU's Institute of Education. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, a new TG Cahir series, Sheila Shoiga on Saol Mara Tá, is a three-part documentary that explores some of the most pressing challenges we're facing as a society today. Parenting, the anxiety epidemic and bullying. Much like Sheila's podcast, Ready to Be Real, it's rooted in listening deeply, asking honest questions and approaching complex issues with compassion rather than judgment. Travelling all over Ireland and to Norway, Sheila speaks with a wide range of people, from well-known faces to experts and individuals sharing their lived experience. And Sheila joins me in studio now. Sheila, you're very welcome.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks for having me.
How lovely to have you here.
I know.
This must have been an amazing project to work on because, as you say, these three topics, parenting, anxiety and bullying, we're all going through them as society.
It. That's exactly it. And when I thought about it, the obvious one is I'm a parent. And then I was wondering, well, does anxiety impact me? Have I experienced bullying? And my honest answer on bullying was absolutely not. And then I started working on this. I started meeting people. I started listening to their experiences and I started reflecting on my own life. And then I realized, wait a second. And it brought me back to early in my career in particular and work situations I was in. And certainly if you were to examine those experiences I had, you would say, in today's language, well, that you experienced bullying. But we didn't have the words for it then. We didn't have the language for it. So it's been really, really interesting for me on a personal level, because as you well know, when you meet people and you're listening to their experiences, you're drinking it up, aren't you? You're taking it in, but you're also thinking about your own life. And these are issues that impact, if not everyone, the majority in one way or another. So I found them really, really interesting. Very difficult at times, very emotional at times, but also there's hope. There's hope here. We don't want people to feel like, oh my God, these are really heavy programs. Why would I sit down and watch them? But we actually do need to listen to people, get different experiences, also have experts sharing their opinion on these topics so that we can hopefully navigate them a bit healthier, because the world is the way it is. We're living in a world that feels really chaotic, as we all know at the moment in particular. And we got to try and help ourselves. And I know you talk about this so much yourself, Claire. We have to try and give ourselves the best possible chance to not just survive in the world, but also to thrive. And we deserve it. Our kids deserve it if it comes to parenting. We deserve it as parents. And, you know, in all of these different areas, they kind of intersect in different ways as well. And I really hope people will feel a sense of being seen when they watch them, and also have a bit more hope that you're not alone in your experience, but also we can all do something to hopefully help ourselves.
Well, let's dive into bullying then a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think when people hear bullying, they're going to instantly think of kids in school and how do we manage that? And that is a big
sure.
issue and one that definitely needs discussing. But you're talking about it beyond the school gate.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't really have a conversation nowadays about bullying without looking at online bullying and the cyber world that is playing such a huge part in this conversation. And as a parent to two young kids, my son is 8 and my daughter is 4. I'm terrified, if I'm totally honest, about the day when they eventually get a phone and that whole world of the internet opens up to them. But I also know that I can't, you know, put my head in the sand and pretend that it's not happening. It's here. And we have to get real about it. We have to really educate ourselves. But also we also have our own, I suppose, sense of, you know, and we spoke before when you were on my pod about boundaries and the importance of having boundaries. We have to, I suppose, challenge the online world with our own kind of boundaries around them, while accepting that this is a world that exists. It's not going away. And if anything, it could potentially get worse before it gets better. But, the bullying documentary is, as you would imagine, dark at times, certainly is, but it's also, I feel like I've learned an awful lot by meeting all the people that I have. And even a conversation with the psychologist, the brilliant Alison Keating. She's fabulous. She gave me, and she will give everyone who watches the documentary, such a sense of, oh, wait a second. We can now have conversations with our kids about how do we empower kids to deal with potential bullies at school or online. And her tips are, for me, a game changer in I suppose, building confidence in kids, in standing up to them from the get-go. It doesn't mean it's never going to happen, but you're giving your kids the best possible chance at I suppose, giving them a sense of good self-worth so that that if it does happen, that they know what the next step is. Also, getting into the mindset of why somebody bullies, what's going on there, you know, and that's a conversation that I was really interested in having because, you know, I don't think somebody is born being a bully. And there's always something else going on behind that as to why somebody is so hurt and so angry and wants to inflict pain on another person. But the impact of bullying can be devastating. And certainly at times it's grim, but as I said, at times it's also really empowering. And I really hope people will, I suppose, open their hearts and watch without judgment as well, because we're speaking to so many different people and getting so many different perspectives on this topic as well. And that's really important when it comes to something as complex as bullying.
And you deal with the bullying and online abuse that female politicians face.
Yes.
And I know your sister Grainne has been very vocal about her own experience. And you speak to Ivana Bacik. And, you know, you said to me before we started hitting record, some of the stories would literally make your hair stand on end.
Absolutely. I was floored when I was listening to her because she has been obviously in public life for decades. She's experienced it all. And some of the stuff she was saying, and it's not that she was saying it as if it didn't bother her, but when you talk about resilience, I think Ivana Bacik is the epitome of that. You know, somebody who has, I suppose with Ivana in particular, I suppose she's somebody who has a very true sense of self. So even though she's experienced abuse, physically on the street abuse, stuff being said to her, physically stuff being hurled at her. But because she knew, I suppose, why she was doing it, her why was so strong, that gave her such confidence to keep going regardless. But nonetheless, you know, she's not a robot, and no politician is, and particularly female politicians. They're a cohort in society that are treated unbelievably badly. I mean, it's frightening, to be honest, the stuff that is said online, and that is just allowed. It's permitted, you know, and we really need to look at that. But Ivana's contribution is a fascinating one. And yet, as a woman who has experienced all the abuse she is so full of hope about the future and about the importance of having women in politics. And it is so important. We need women like Ivana. We need women like Holly Kearns. We need these incredibly strong voices. And even though it's difficult when you look at situations like my sister, who really put her heart and soul into her campaign and did incredible work, but it wasn't successful in the end. She can still hold her head high that she gave it everything. It wasn't successful this time, but we do need women taking up seats, and also us as voters. We need to be voting, you know, strong candidates into the Dáil who can speak on our behalf.
And I think as a society, we need to move to a place where we understand we're not all going to agree on everything. And we need to allow polar opinions to coexist and try and meet with some sort of respect and understanding of where people might be coming from. And I know that sounds very difficult, especially with some of the opinions we're having to live with right now that seem very black and white to all of us. But at the same time, we'll never move forward if we can't really listen to each other. Can I ask you about parenting then? Because I think it's really refreshing. I saw the promo clip for the series and you have a parent there who says, look, I'm really grateful, but my life has also been turned upside down.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that is what's really refreshing because, you know, children are yearned for, you know, it's not a given that you will have a child.
For sure.
And yet it can be really, really challenging.
Absolutely. And we travelled all over the country meeting parents with, like, we went to Monaghan, we met a family who's this child is severely disabled. We spend time with Nyasa, who you mentioned there, who has three kids, and she is juggling like a mad thing. She was getting ready to go back into the workplace, but she had to make a very difficult decision to leave the job that she absolutely loved. I'm giving everything away, and I don't want to give everything away, but basically, these are the decisions we make. These are the choices that are presented to us when we have a family where it's not, it can't be the way it always was. Things have to evolve. Things have to change. And we also live in a world that is go, 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 grind, 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 you know, and most people have to work to be able to pay their mortgages. But then childcare is so expensive, and then you have to make a decision whether it's worth your while, two parents being in the workplace. And we're looking at how can we do better? What is the current situation? What needs to happen? And actually, we spoke to Orla O'Connor from the National Women's, the Women's Council of Ireland. And she was talking about, you know, the Nordic model, particularly in Norway, and how it's done there. So we went off to Norway and we got a sense of what life is really like raising kids there. So we, there's an Irish woman living there with her husband and raising her two girls there. And it was really interesting to get a flavour of what life is like there. And is this a way that we could bring in more into Ireland? And there's obviously huge supports in Norway for families. But in saying that, look, you know, and people will see the programme and decide for themselves, but we are under phenomenal pressure in this generation. And you do think back of when we were kids, and most experts say the pressure that parents are under now is next level. It just is. And it's important to kind of sit with it and ask why. Why is it like this? You know, it's the world is kind of set up so that it's very difficult to thrive, but we want people to be able to. And sometimes that means making tough decisions and ones that might affect your pocket, but might be more fulfilling in other ways. So, yeah, I hope it'll be a thought. I know it's going to be a thought-provoking one for people, because it certainly was for me. And I always feel if it's happening for me, it'll happen for those watching it as well. But yeah, we cover so much, so many different perspectives, male, female, and really the question is, if you're struggling in the world right now, it's normal, because, you know, it's not really set up to support families, and we do absolutely need to look at that.
And I know you have Jerry Hussey on the podcast series, and he speaks a lot about how we as a society are, you know, very much focused on, you know, getting the kids into a sleep routine, getting ourselves back to work. And that's the modern day life that you're talking about. And he's kind of questioning that.
Yes.
I know you've also had Gabor Maté on your podcast. Mm. He speaks about it as well, the anxiety epidemic that we're having. And yet, as a modern society, we're not giving ourselves that time to truly connect with our kids the way we were designed to. And even as a parent, that made me feel defensive. And he kind of puts his hand up and says, listen, I was a busy physician. Mm. I wasn't around for my kids either. But if we don't talk about this, and if we don't ask these questions, then nothing will ever change. So there is an initial defensiveness with all of these things, isn't there? But if we just bring our shoulders down and listen, I always think it begins, change begins with a conversation.
Completely. And even I have to have compassion with myself. Like, my son is 8 now and our daughter is 4. And we co-sleep with Cliona. And hands down, it's been the most gorgeous, natural thing we've ever done for her and for us. It's amazing. And I would love to go back in time, and I'd get emotional now thinking about it, and take Cahill out of that bloody cot and bring him into bed. Ugh. We're going against nature. And when you look at why co-sleeping was frowned upon, it was two childless men back in the day that suggested this, because they wanted people out working. And it's not natural to separate yourself from your kid. We have a daughter now who's in her waking hours is the most independent little being, because she's getting all this connection. She's getting all of this security at night. It is honestly the most natural thing. I don't understand it. She sleeps amazing. We sleep great. Luckily, we have a big bed. We bought a big bed when we built our house. And I know the day will come when she won't want to be in the bed, but I don't want that day to end, because it's the most gorgeous thing. It just completely makes sense. And I really, as I said, I have to have compassion for the earlier version of me as a mother. But honest to God, I your babies need to be held. They want to be held. And what you'll actually find is a very securely attached, comfortable kid who won't be needy. it's the opposite, because when they're getting that security and love and connection, they're like, she will go into her Nindra and she doesn't even look behind. She's like, see ya. Good luck, mom. Whatever. There's no tears. There's no drama. And I hope I'm not coming across smug. I really am not trying to, but I feel really strongly about this. I think we've just got it arseways. But again, if you had that conversation with me 8 years ago, I would have been saying, no, no. And I was lying on the floor with my hand through the cot and Cahill crying.
Yeah, no, we've all been there.
But I just want to go back and I want to hug me and say, stop going against your instinct. I was going against my instinct. Take your baby out of the cot, hold your baby, bring your baby into the bed. This is the normal thing. When you look at the animal kingdom, what does the baby tiger do? The babies cuddle in with their parents, with their mother. It's normal, natural. And anyway.
And modern society sets it up, though, because you're going back to work after 6 months. So you need to be getting a good night's sleep. You need them. So the intention is always good. But
it is. But I have a real aversion to hearing it now. And you leave your baby down and you let them cry. No, you don't let them cry. And you'll find that when they are being cuddled and minded, they don't cry anyway. They're not crying the same way because they're getting that natural bonding. Anyway, yeah, I could go on forever.
You mentioned your big bed in your new house. So life is good.
By the way, I still have a very healthy life with my husband. Okay.
FYI. Messages.
Do you know what I mean? But no, honestly, yeah. So we built a home and we're in it, and sure, we're still going to be doing stuff probably for the next 10 to 20 years. But it's lovely to be there because we were living in a mobile home for 2 years while we were building, which was mad.
Well, it looks perfect from what I've seen in the magazine
pages.
We're
very
lucky. Yeah, it looks beautiful.
We're very lucky. And I
right
know.
Right in spittle.
Yeah, right in spittle.
Sea view all around.
Yeah.
And you got married. A surprise wedding, not for your nearest and dearest, but for us Instagrammers.
Yeah. So it was really low key. We basically made the decision, what are we waiting on? It was actually more our son than anything else, because he was saying, what's the story? Like, why are you not married? You know, he's getting to that age where he was kind of going, Mom, what? What, this doesn't make sense.
That's your boyfriend?
Yeah, what?
And each to their own, of course.
Do you know what I mean? And then we were kind of like, it was getting more complex as the older he gets. And I suppose when the critical thinking kind of kicks in, he's just going, nah, this doesn't add up. So we were like, okay, we were focused on the house, I suppose. We always knew we'd get married eventually. And I said, okay, we just do it. And then when we really spoke about what we wanted, we just said, we don't need to go big here. Also, to be honest, financially, there was a huge factor there, because if I wanted to go big, I'm all or nothing. I'd want to go big. And we didn't have the money for it. You know, the house was taking up and we want to put the money into the house anyway. So we decided to do something really low key, and it was lovely. It was just our families in a hotel, like 5 minutes over the road. It's the Connemara coast in Faribault. It was the most lovely day. Like, the weather was lovely. And they have a gazebo outside. We got married outside. It was so nice.
With your two kids there, I think it's beautiful. So nice. For your kids to see it, yes. I think is really lovely.
Yeah, it was really lovely. And they were such a huge part of the whole ceremony, you know. So it was gorgeous, yeah.
Good. Well, look, I think this series is going to absolutely fly and cause some really thought-provoking conversations. And I think it's really important. It starts on February 11th. Parenting is on February 11th at 9:45. Anxiety, February 18th, the following week at 9:30. And bullying, the following week, February 25th at 9:30. Sheila Shoiga on Saol Mar Atá is on TG Cathair soon. And thank you so much for coming in to tell me about it.
Thanks a million for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.